Back in 1971, when I was a student in seminary, my advisor shared with me an evaluation he wrote on me for his class. He wrote some good things, but then he said something like, "I don't believe she really knows, really understands death and loss." Death and loss are, of course, crucial areas of human experience for a minister to know about. But I was very young. I had had, at that point in my life, only limited experience of personal loss, and no one at that point very close to me had died. My experience in the life of congregations at that point was likewise limited. In the intervening years, however, the cloudier side of life has certainly caught up with me, as it does sooner or later with all of us. I have certainly had my share of personal loss, downtimes, illness, the death of people close to me, the pain and regrets and feeling of emptiness and sometimes anger that goes with losses and difficulties. I have also, in these decades of ministry, heard many stories of suffering from people in the churches I've served. Losses and tragedies so profound as to shake and shatter one's life to its very foundations. As the wise one, Gautama Siddhartha, known as the Buddha, said, "Life is dukkha." That is, impermanence and the stress and suffering that goes with it. In short, the Buddha said, life is a very bumpy road. You may remember the story of the Buddha's awakening, a story that is an allegory of the growth of our awareness of misfortune and of suffering as we age. The Buddha, when young, was a prince, protected by his father from the king, from the ills of the world. Young Gautama lived entirely within the palace walls, in a kind of Eden before the fall. At his birth, his father had been given a prophecy about his son. The soothsayer said that he would either turn out to be a great king or a great religious leader. To ensure that it would be the former, the king kept his naive son locked inside the comfortable palace environment. But one day, without his father's knowledge, Gautama left the palace, and he happened to see a beggar on the road. He asked his charioteer, "Who is that, and why is he so thin? What is that bowl?" His driver answered, "That's a beggar. He doesn't have enough to eat, so he begs with his bowl for a scrap of food." On succeeding days, as the story goes, Gautama snuck beyond the palace walls and saw in turn a very ill person, an old man bent over, and then someone who was being carried in a processional, a corpse. The Buddha asked anxiously, "Will I become ill? Will I get old and bent? Will I die?" "Yes, Master," his charioteer had to answer. Before these excursions, Gautama knew nothing of suffering, infirmity, aging, or death. His new awareness set him on the path that was to lead to his great spiritual awakening and to his religious leadership. Well, when young, I was like Gautama, the protected prince. Well, not quite. I was an English lit major, after all, so I had read all of Shakespeare's tragedies and a good many more literary stories and poetic lamentations about the condition of human suffering. I even wrote about life's suffering myself. But what did I really know? I had been lucky. I had not experienced pain, suffering, and loss to any significant degree. Like Gautama, although usually at a slower pace, as we move from innocence through experience after experience, it dawns on us that life is indeed a bumpy road. My understanding of this has grown and deepened over the years, and it is growing still. I know that there are yet more bumps and potholes ahead. Sometimes I just want to sigh with the ache of it all. Don't you? And yet, I am also continually learning as I age that life gives us much when we are open to receiving it, that there is much to rejoice in. As time goes on, most of us come to realize that life itself, which we may have taken for granted when younger, life itself is an incredible and miraculous gift, and that it is studded with diamonds, little moments of joy. The experience of love, the consolation of community, the inspiration of art and music and poetry, the awesome beauty of nature, the joy of spiritual growth, the satisfaction of learning new things, feelings of well-being and peace. These are woven into life's tapestry as well. But how can we be sustained through the rough times, the times when we might feel like the biblical Job, hard hit by misfortune and uncomprehending as how such bad things can happen to us? What can help us get through the times when we are so beset by grief or heartbreak or unhappiness that we lose sight of life's gifts? We know that not everyone does get through the rough patches. Witness the recent suicide of Robin Williams, who had all that we could imagine might make a person happy, including his wonderful sense of humor and his gift of performance. What is it that helps one person survive and even thrive while another is knocked so far down that he or she gives up? There are a few things I've gleaned from my own and from others' experiences with pain, loss, and misfortune that I believe can be helpful, and I'd like to share these. The first is to look your despair square in the eye. Meet the darkness head on and even dwell with it for a time. As the poet Theodore Ruffke put it, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. If you've ever taken a night nature walk on a moonless night, you know that it is very disorienting and even frightening at first not to be able to see at all, not even your hand in front of your face. But after a while, your eyes begin to adjust, and you can begin to make out shapes and recognize things, and you are actually seeing in a new way. Likewise, in the midst of an emotional dark time, if we stay with it long enough, we may begin to recognize and understand our lives and life in general in a new and a different way. There is a natural tendency to avoid or squelch emotional pain by going back to business as usual, perhaps too soon after a loss, or by dousing the problem with alcohol or escapist drugs or other diversionary behaviors. Lots of people do retail therapy at these times and hit the stores. But pain, though it is unwanted, it can be a teacher. Untended wounds have a way of opening up at unexpected times and bleeding again, hurting us time and time again, keeping us stuck in cycles and waves of despair. While those wounds that we give some attention to may begin the slow process of healing. This little poem by Pesha Gardner speaks of the need to dwell in the darkness for a while and pay attention to what the pain may have to teach. It's called the healing time. Finally, on my way to yes, I bump into all the places where I said no to my life. All the untended wounds, those red and purple scars, those hieroglyphs of pain, carved into my skin, my bones, those coded messages that send me down the wrong street again and again, where I find them, the old wounds, the old misdirections, and I lift them one by one close to my heart, and I say, holy, holy. A second coping mechanism after facing the pain squarely is keeping a realistic perspective. It is all too easy for many optimists to forget when times are good that hardship will befall us, that some pain, some loss and misfortune are bound to catch up with us if we live long enough. Folks who deny the dark side of life are apt to be rudely stunned and especially hard hit with depression and despair when difficulty does come. Likewise, more pessimistically inclined folks, and nearly all of us when times are rough, have trouble remembering those little diamonds of joy, those little points of satisfaction and well-being that are also part of the intricate fabric of life. When hardship and loss and pain make a visit, remember that this is a real part of life, but don't mistake it for all of reality. By this realism, I don't mean that we should apply the common salve that we sometimes try to smear over a tragedy when we say, look on the bright side. Of course, there may be a bright side even to tragedy. For instance, when a death comes mercifully to one who has been suffering. But sometimes there just is no bright side. Not every cloud has a silver lining. But it is helpful to know that somewhere else the sun is shining and that it can shine again on us as well. A third mechanism for dealing with these losses in our lives is to try to remember, in both bad times and good, to praise and to bless those things in life that are true blessings. A scholar of Judaism, Professor Joe Milgram, from whom I took a class during a brief sabbatical leave some years back, spoke of barukas, or blessings, which in Judaism are thank you prayers or blessings for the many little gifts of life. And no matter what your circumstances, there are bound to be blessings embedded in your life. Professor Milgram often assigns her students to spend one day being very aware of these barukas in life. And she even made us record 100 thank yous in a day to share with the rest of the class. It's amazing when you do this kind of exercise how many usually unacknowledged barukas we have, even when we are in the midst of some difficulty. The late great tennis player Arthur Ashe once said, I am a fortunate, blessed man. Aside from AIDS and heart disease, I have no problems. Cultivating an affirming outlook may sustain us and may even save us. 4, stay connected to others. This one seems like a no-brainer. Of course, it helps to have supportive people around in a crisis or during periods of hardship. But we need to acknowledge the tendency, sometimes the need, for alone time during the healing process. When an animal is wounded, it slinks off by itself to nurse its wounds. So too, we may need to be by ourselves at times, or for a time. But we humans, most of us, also need community to help heal and to thrive. Sometimes it's a matter of letting people in who are already there to help and who want to be useful. We may not even know how much support and friendship there is for us until we are hit by misfortune. Sometimes we need to create community for ourselves, seeking out support groups of people who are or who have been in similar circumstances, or joining intentional communities of people, like joining and becoming more active in a religious group such as this, or finding a social or special interest group to belong to. And fifth, another thing that has helped me is nurturing and cultivating, when possible, a sense of humor. Humor can be healing because it requires us to at least partly transcend ourselves and the pathos of our situation for a brief time. Garrison Keillor has said, humor is not a trick, a joke. Humor is a presence in the world like grace and shines on everyone. This gracious presence of humor can and does lead to healing, not just of the mind and spirit, but as research shows, of the body as well. You might think that when people are grieving the loss of a loved one who has died, that humor somehow seems out of place, but I have seen it work wonders. For instance, when meeting with family members and hearing them reminisce about the humorous outlook or antics of the deceased, or at memorial services when some humorous stories and reminiscences are told and everyone chuckles for a moment, cherishing a delightful memory. Humor has helped me through hard times when, like Norman Cousins during his serious illness, I have deliberately sought out humorous books and films to lift my spirits. Cousins did it with the Marx Brothers. I do it with Monty Python and old Saturday Night Live episodes. It works, even if only briefly. Some years ago, I was in a tight-knit little group of colleagues. There were seven of us. We were members of the executive committee of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association nationally. We met four times a year for 2 years in semi-exotic places like Catalina Island, Las Vegas, and the Green Gulch Zen Center in Marin. After each meeting, when the day's work was done, we would go snorkeling or take in a show or play poker into the wee hours. I have heard that other UUMA execs, as we call them, were more practical and more serious than we were. But we also got the job done. At the time I was on the UUMA exec, there was a popular ironic phrase circulating in the culture. You may remember this phrase: life is hard, and then you die. Remember that? Another version that made the rounds was, life's a bitch, and then you die. But some more fun-loving souls turned this latter dryly humorous phrase into, life's a beach. That one you saw a lot on bumper stickers back then. They left off the then you die part as well. Life's a beach. Well, we in our little ministers group liked it straight. And in our casual conversations, we'd sometimes shake our heads and say semi-humorously, life is hard, and then you die. But our little group made an important editorial addition. Life is hard, and then you die. Hallelujah, anyway. It became our motto. We never needed to explain to each other what it meant. We all understood that what we were expressing was the need to celebrate, to praise, to bless life in spite of its challenges and hardships. In the space of 10 years after I was part of that little group, one member died in her mid-50s. One had a serious heart attack and a series of strokes. One suffered a hard blow to his ministerial career, and two of us got divorced. The road has been bumpy, as the Buddha said it was so many centuries ago. But we still need to praise life, to enjoy it, to celebrate it, and to bless it. So, hallelujah, 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 anyway.